Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, hello, Internet. This is Kimberly Chow. I am one of the directors of Food Book Fair, an annual festival about writing about eating, and one of your co-hosts for Recommended Reading on Heritage Radio Network. It's just me today. I'm without my other half, Amanda Dell. Oh, well-timed, DJ Dave. So, plot twist, I'm actually going to throw it to our engineer, Dave Tadashore, and ask him what he's been reading, watching, and listening to kick off the show.
Wow, this really is a surprise. We didn't plan this at all, and I'm not being sarcastic. You know what? Honestly, very little, because I have been up to my eyeballs in editing our new Modernist Breadcrumbs series.
Nice cross promo.
Yeah, it's a new 8-part mini series that we are doing for Modernist Bread, Modernist Cuisine. I don't know if you're familiar with those books. Have you seen or heard of those before?
Yes, I have.
Oh, okay.
I'm really excited. I've yet to lay hands on Modernist Bread in real life, but I can't wait to see it.
We have also not had the pleasure. I mean, we had an event with them at MOFAD, but we were not given a copy of the book, sadly.
Burr.
Yeah, it's
both.
It's cold in here.
I see hot and cold.
It's cold in here today.
Well, I'm glad that you've been putting in the good work for that so folks can enjoy
Me
that
too.
Podcast. When can people listen to it?
Well, they can listen to episode 1 now. That is up on the Heritage Radio Network website, and episode 2 will be released tomorrow.
Cool, cool. I'll have to add it to my queue. Plus one. In the meantime, I have been mostly finding solace in cookbooks in the catastrophic times we've been living in. I was just most recently in LA, in the desert outside of LA, and then driving up into Northern California, Bay Area, wine country. And, you know, really reflecting on what's going on there with the wildfires and how it's affecting the many, many wine producers as well as ranchers, farmers that are out there, and what that's going to mean for our food system. So hang tight, folks out in Sonoma and Napa. I've been holding my Rancho Gordo beans real close, and also just taking time, reflecting, walking, thinking about our connections to food. I've been finding, as I said, inspiration and solace. Also, I was staying at a friend's house in Northern California where they had a copy of David Tanis's One Good Dish, which I had never seen before, shot by Gentle and Hires, other Food Book Fair friends, and was able to sit down and consume that slowly and savor it. And then I've been reading at home the Cheers to the Publican book by Paul Kahn and Cosmo Gross, and from the Publican in Chicago, a place I really love to eat, and the only place that I've ever been undersold, basically told that I'd ordered too much food, but it was really true. When you order mussels there, it comes with its own loaf of bread. It's a demi baguette, but it's still the biggest demi baguette I've ever seen. Love that joint. And then also Nopalito by Gonzalo Guzman and Stacey Adamando. And that book has so much heart and so much goodness in that. And I can't wait to cook from that. Now that I have my Rancho Gordo hominy back with me.
You're ready to go.
In Brooklyn, I'm ready to go. And that's the sound of Evan Hanser from Egg Restaurant, the chef there. And we are so hyped to welcome him. And George Weld, the owner of Egg. Give it up, guys.
Hello.
Hey, we are two people who probably need our own personal assistant undersellers when we go to restaurants. So it sounds like the publican's our kind of place. Maybe could have used it at lunch.
Yeah.
What did we order today? We ordered a lot of stuff. We usually just order pizza with our other guests. So I do have to commend you for going for the appetizer section because that was really tasty, sweet potato, crispy situation.
Yeah. I feel like that's the thing I tell people about Roberta's when they come here, tell me they're coming here from out of town. Like, definitely get the pizzas, but so many of the best things I've had here have been salads or sides or appetizers of some sort.
Yep, you got to hit all the parts.
And we did.
Yeah, we did. So if you get here anytime soon, and I think this will be on the menu for a minute because it is a great fall edition and we're going to be eating root vegetables for the next 4 months. They have a sweet, it's like a crisp sweet potato. Smashed sweet potato, there's a chimichurri, there's some kind of pickly red onion vin situation.
Yeah, it's so broccoli good. They had something.
Broccoli rabe, rapini.
Oh, yeah. Eggs. Don't forget the eggs. Two eggs.
Oh, there were two eggs.
Yeah.
You ate the first egg while
it was gone. before you noticed. we were also reminded that like one of the our favorite dishes at Egg in the fall and basically as long as we can keep them going into the spring is sort of a similarly minded crispy sweet potato dish. I think I might have first had the variety of the white flesh Japanese sweet potatoes that are particularly like complex and earthy and sweet here a few years ago. And we started running them with different companions at Egg. And everyone can't get enough of them. It's like
it's one of the dishes that can stay on the menu just for me.
Right.
I order it so much that.
What do you pair it with, or what are you pairing it with right now?
We haven't started yet. We'll probably have it in a couple weeks or so. We're still plowing through the late summer produce we're getting from our farm, Goatfell Upstate.
Shout out to Goatfell Farm.
Shout out to Goatfell. It's been unbelievable this year. Chuck has been laying the produce on us thick. Tomatoes, peppers. We're still getting amazing turnips from up there. Kale. All sorts of pretty little flowers and herbs. Mm. It's been a revelation of a year.
It's been great.
That sounds delicious. But we'd love to hear more. We would love to hear more about the farm and what you're getting and what you guys are cooking up, but also what you're eating and reading, because today is the day before the very next installment of Tables of Contents. Still one of the best names I wish I had come up with.
I wish we had come up with it. I think
we came up with it.
Yeah, maybe we came up with it.
Should we tell the backstory to this?
About how we got shut down for our previous name?
Oh, yeah. What was it?
This was right before my time.
Cooking by the Book.
Cooking by the Book, yeah.
So, dear listeners out there, if you are new to Tables of Contents, it is an amazing reading series about once a month at Egg Restaurant in Williamsburg. Featuring live authors, living authors,
living
authors, living and live authors who read excerpts from their books paired with a snack by Chef Evan and mini biscuits as well and beer and wine, all for a small donation. It's super dope, super fun. It's also been a series of dinners that have found their way to Milan, to Miami, but started in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to Food Book Fair. We've done a series of dinners under the Tables of Contents name at Egg, and we've done dinners inspired by non-living authors, literary classics.
Right.
Everything from Their Eyes Were Watching God to The Sun Also Rises to My Side of the Mountain.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes.
There's one more, right?
Tender Buttons.
There's a few more. Tender Buttons, the Gertrude Stein poem.
Tender Buttons. That's a weird and awesome one.
It's so full of food.
Yeah. Some of the most amazing, strangest dishes I've certainly ever made and paired with their strange and amazing titles. That was a really cool one. We did The Member of the Wedding, which is great. And then I think we always forget about the Eat the City dinner we did.
Yeah, Robin Schulman.
Yeah, which is actually how we met Imran and Madani, who now for years has supplied us with our poultry, one of the last slaughterhouses within city limits that does things really well.
Our only nonfiction.
Yeah, I think it's our only nonfiction.
That's also an awesome book.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
For New York food people and anyone who cares about how cities eat and how people eat. Eat the City by Rahman Schulman. We've done a series of dinners together, and now Tables of Contents has many, many different multi-layered lives.
Yeah.
So can you tell us about what will be happening tomorrow night at Egg?
Sure. Tomorrow we have three authors on a given night that has proven to be the winning formula. You get a good mix of dishes, good taste of different styles and different stories. So tomorrow we have Alexandra Kleeman coming back for her volume 2 reading. She was one of our first authors when the reading series began to emerge from the dinner series into its own thing. She came in and read from her brilliantly titled, as we were talking about over lunch, novel,
You Too Can Have a Body Like Mine.
Exactly. And now she's back. She wrote a collection of stories, I think it came out at the end of last year, actually called Intimations. So she's going to be reading from one of those stories. I won't blow the surprise of what's going to be coming out of the kitchen for each of these, but really excited to have her back, as well as Alex Gilvary, I believe is how you pronounce it, or Gilvary. I'm not sure where the emphasis goes, but he wrote a book called Eastman Was Here that's received a ton of great reception.
I read his first book.
Oh, what was his first
Which
book?
Was, it's escaping me, but basically... it's about a fashion designer who is accused of being a terrorist, and then hijinks ensue.
Wow!
It's a dark comedy.
Hijinks ensue. I love that that trailing.
It's
end
a fashion
of a
designer that ends up at Guantanamo. It's,
okay. Ugh.
But hijinks ensue.
Also ensue. Well, this is set in Vietnam and New York, and I was reading through some excerpts from it the other day. Really excited to get into that and to cook from it.
Cool.
And then our third author is Hernan Diaz, who teaches up at Columbia and has written this really cool sort of austere historical nonfiction Western style, like sort of like Western-ish frontier novel called In the Distance, which has, as far as I can tell, an unbelievable amount of amazing food descriptions, even in a pretty barren sort of food landscape, as you can imagine that taking place, that I'm also extremely excited to cook from and to talk with all of them, sort of see how the food made its way into their pieces and in what ways and why. Yeah.
How do you find the authors that you work with and are inspired by for the series?
For the most part, it's been through word of mouth, you know, authors recommending authors, which is the best. It's like, when people ask George or I, you know, where to eat when they visit New York, you know, it's like, that's how you actually hear about the people you want to be reading, I think, instead of trying to sift through the noise of all the PR campaigns for new books coming out. And then, as I mentioned, in moments of desperation, I'll look at like the McNally Jackson events list and just steal some ideas off of there, or look at some sort of, you know, 10 best young this or 10 new that or whatever sort of awards lists or nominations lists, and try to cold call some people, which has turned up good success. And sometimes I'll see an author say something funny on Twitter or something and be like, that sounds like a person I'd like to
have cook with. In.
Yeah. So kind of all over the place. We have a running list, like a spreadsheet, where George and Ann Foster, who helps produce the series, and I will throw names on there and get in touch with, or at least get ideas for who we might want to bring in the future.
Is it always fiction writers?
It's pretty much been fiction.
Adam Gopnik was on there a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Although it was like a collection of stories that he read from.
Mm-hmm.
But we've had authors in who also write poetry and have talked about how to incorporate nonfiction or poetry, whether to make a special sort of night for those genres or just to work them in without ceremony to the normal Tables of Contents nights.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not we're not devoted solely to fiction, but it's been so far the way the creative interaction has happened. And it's kind of how the series started, with cooking from fiction as a way to taste something you might have only imagined.
It also kind of cuts out a whole range of easy, like the Eat the City book was fun and easy to do because it's literally it's descriptions of food.
Right.
Yeah, it's more like a lot of what Evan does is not just make food that's described in the book, but find some way to interpret some passage in the book through food so that it becomes its own kind of representation of what the writer did.
Yeah.
So that becomes like, it's more fun to do that, I think, with fiction, because it's not, you know, I think one of our favorite dishes was in the Sun Also Rises dinner. There's a scene that was inspired by a bull ring, and it was, you know, bull's blood beets and some dust, some...
like a mushroom powder.
Yeah, mushroom powder.
A couple kinds of beef, like a tartare and a roasted ribeye or whatever it was we cooked in Italy, like a bistecca.
Oh,
that was so good. but yeah, it's cool to take inspiration, not only, like George was saying, from the dishes mentioned or the ingredients mentioned, but from a feeling or a scene, and try to represent it in food. Sometimes that's when the coolest ideas emerge.
Like the burning fat.
Yeah.
Good one. The candle. Was that in the same dish?
No, this is a different dish. This is one of Evan's great hits. It was a fat artist, I think.
He should release an album. Oh, yeah, Benjamin Hale.
Yeah.
He wrote The Fat Artist.
There's a book that was just like, it was the main character in this story was trying to eat everything.
It was like performance art.
The art was, he was going to try to gain as much weight as humanly possible.
And this book is called The Fat Artist.
Yeah. And he was like in a glass encasing in a museum.
Like,
and he had to eat everything that anyone brought him.
Right. So it was full of food, but, you know, rather than pick some arbitrary piece of food out of the list of things that got brought to him, Evan brought out little jars of, they're beef tallow candles and bread. So you dip the candle, melted the beef fat, and you dip bread in it, and
you're just eating the fat.
It's pretty awesome. It's
also delicious.
Yeah.
Oh, I like, was it also in the glass, in a glass jar?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It just looked like a candle. Ooh, but then you start eating it.
That's such a good echo.
Yeah.
I like that when it's conceptual and literary rather than literal.
Yeah.
So, you know, cooking straight literally is fun too.
Totally.
But I think there's so much room to play, and you obviously both take so much joy and pleasure out of that.
Yeah.
For our listeners who don't know, y'all are also both writers. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship between food and writing and how that's evolved over time as you've been producing the series, if it has evolved over time?
Yeah, I mean, I got into food professionally by not wanting to write, like trying to avoid. I had I was in grad school in Boston, and my desk was in the kitchen, and I would work all morning long and like count the minutes before it was like reasonable for me to start cooking instead of writing.
What were you pursuing in grad school?
I was getting a master's in poetry. Continued to do that kind of thing. So I went on after that to Virginia to attempt to get a PhD, and just kept cooking. So the relationship for me initially was sort of displacement. Like, I'd rather be doing something that gives people immediate pleasure, that gives me immediate pleasure, than like working through this kind of abstract process that generates something that very few people will even think to look to for pleasure. But it ended up like tying them together really intimately. And then I think when I started cooking at an egg, I kind of like thought, I'm done with writing. I'll never have to go back to words. But there's no... Ultimately, I think, you know, there's such an interesting tension between them, because it's really hard to write well about food, you know, it's because it's so sensual and so physical, and it's so easy to be trite or gross or, you know, pornographic about it. At the same time, it's so easy to eat and enjoy. Like, trying to figure out some way to like deal with that, like to bring them into harmony, I guess, in a way, has been sort of what I've been doing for the past 12 years. And
when we do the reading series, we'll talk with the authors at the end about all sorts of things, but usually end up talking about of course, writing about food and what it, the difficulties in it, and how it's sort of like writing about sex in some ways, where it's like there's a really fine line to walk before it gets, you know, you either give too much information or too little, mm-hmm. so that you can't get into it or you can't wait to get out of it, that scene as a reader. And the ways that food is an effective tool or an important part of stories. And we find that almost every writer, even the ones who say, when I approach them about the series, oh, there's not really that much food in my book, but, you know, I'd love to try to be involved. There's always, you know, moments where food plays a critical role, mm-hmm. in some even minute way, which has been really cool to search those moments out and bring them more into the light. Yeah. Of that scene, and have heard from authors too that sort of help them realize how important the food that they're putting in there, maybe without a ton of thought, you know, mm-hmm. just sort of like in the flow of the scene, yeah. is helping to shape it. Yeah, and for me, when I started at Egg, I was coming to cooking sort of like George, but more reluctantly. I was like, well, I'm going to cook for a little bit, but I'm going to be out of here soon. Writing again.
Literally what he said in this interview.
And you hired him.
Still hired.
Yeah, of course I did.
It must have been desperate or something.
No. Instant kinship.
Yeah, right. And George's like, oh, you think so, but really. let me show you how it goes. but I think both of us came back, like became really excited after a few years of working together and cooking together and really just focusing on running the restaurant, mm-hmm. and making food, to the exclusion of most other goals. When the idea and the opportunity came up to bring food and writing back together in a way that maybe had somehow, you know, those things had settled together in just the right way in both of our heads, and we'd come to the appropriate relationship with each, you know, in our own minds, we were able to get back into it and be like, oh, we can do both of these things and bring them together in an interesting sort of conversation. And that was obviously exciting enough for us to start the dinner series, mm-hmm. And to carry it out for, I don't know, 6 or so years now, 5 years now.
However long Food Book Fair is.
Yeah.
So is
6 years?
Table of Contents.
Yeah.
Just a flashback. I think we alluded to this, but what did Table of Contents used to be? And it how did you come up with the name Tables of Contents?
Well, it was called Cooking by the Book.
Cooking by the Book, we first, like for the first couple of dinners, I think.
Yeah,
for years.
That.
And then we got a, what do you call it? A
cease and desist.
from a executive cooking school and executive experience. Yeah, corporate bonding situation in Manhattan.
Somewhere downtown. They're like,
so we had to come up with some other name.
That was what they called their situation?
They called it.
Yeah, I think
Cooking by the Book, and they, I think, have a trademark on it.
It was the best cease and desist we could have ever gotten because it led us somehow to Tables of Contents. I feel like one of our former cooks, Alan Berman, was involved, or maybe Charlie Harrell was involved. There were a lot of proposals floating around as we were
a very
moving on
ripe
from
moment
Cooking by the
in
Book,
the atmosphere of the restaurant for good ideas.
It was sort of like. Like you don't know exactly how and when like a mushroom decides to emerge in the wild, but it does.
That's
like,
a really good
there's
analog.
There's a lot of things happening under the surface, and then here it came.
Or the Tables universe.
Of Contents. Or the universe.
True.
Do you attract a lot of other writers and creative folks? I mean, I think the restaurant industry does in general. Everyone has something they're doing at night or during the day or other creative pursuits. But I feel, and maybe this is just knowing you and knowing the atmosphere and the vibe of the space. Do you attract other writers, whether as diners or whether as people that come and work with you, that come up with great titles or are just inspired by the food?
I guess it sort of seems so. I don't know what the ratio of writers in employment in restaurants are around the city. I imagine it's pretty common, but we've had a good string of people working with us who have, if not focused solely on writing, definitely had a, you know, creative pursuit that involves some sort of, whether it was screenwriting or acting or writing fiction or I mean at Egg, as far as the customer base goes, I think we've been in a neighborhood that at least for a while people who were writing and doing creative things were able to afford and wanted to live in, and so we ended up having a bunch of regulars who worked in those areas. I mean,
I feel like my experience as a writer and as a restaurant person is like, writers never think they have enough money to go out to eat. And so they don't. I think there's something, you know, there's something shocking about going into a restaurant when your main preoccupation is sitting in a room by yourself, and you know, they're pretty violent spaces. I think musicians tend to love it. I mean, we've always had a lot of musicians
come in.
Yeah, and there's like, you know, and actors also. But writers, I feel like, I also have to say that in my personal experience with writers, a lot of them have had really unpleasant relationships with food. Like, not like trouble, but just like, don't care about it, don't think about it. I think it comes up
ask this question a lot.
Yeah.
During Tables of Contents, there's always a Q&A at the end with the authors, and sometimes you talk about the content, sometimes you talk about what else they're working on and what they're reading, and you also ask them what they eat when and sometimes they're like, I don't eat all day, so I can stay at my desk. Right.
Coffee.
Was the red pepper flakes all day.
Yeah. Sarah Gerard's just picking at a jar of red pepper flakes a couple at a time and ultimately finishing it.
One of my favorite food passages in all of writing was I can't remember which book it was. Paul Auster talks about living in the south of France and trying to make a living as a translator and coming to the point where all they had left in their house was a little flour and some onions. And they made I'm not going to pronounce this in French, like a onion tart, a caramelized onion tart. It's like, I was in grad school in a, you know, drafty attic working, and I read that and went straight downstairs and did the same thing. Like, that's the kind of food I think of, like writers eating. I say this out of love, you know, but like most writers I know are not.
That's funny. I feel like
high on the hog.
I did the same sort of things when I was in college. Like, I had this book by Simon Hopkinson, and my favorite recipe in it, the most, you know, mangled page in there is the onion tart recipe. It's just like a ton of onions, a little bit of cream, and a pastry crust, and like a couple of eggs or something. And I would make that when I was just starting to cook for myself or for anyone. And I was like, wow, this is so cheap and so delicious.
Yeah.
And
sometimes that inexpensive and simple food is the hardest to perfect and something you can work on again and again, but also the most delicious.
Yeah. I mean,
in the David Tanis book, One Good Dish, there's a recipe for it's spaghetti with breadcrumbs and garlic, I think. And he says, this is what you make when you don't have anything else in the cupboard, but you can't really be bothered to go outside and you don't have to buy anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just a combination of fat,
seasoning
and starch, starches.
I mean, it's like been said many times, but all the food, not all, but I think most of the food people celebrate originated as peasant food in a certain culture. And there's a reason, like you had to make something delicious without too much to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we keep going back to.
I think that's a good time to take a break. We're going to take a quick break so we can keep the lights on, as my partner Amanda likes to say, because we are part of Heritage Radio Network. You can visit us at heritageradionetwork.org to listen to us or the slate of several dozen other amazing shows all about in and around food. Heritage Radio Network, it is an amazing member-funded radio network. So check it out. Click on the beating heart on the website so you can support us. And we'll be right back.
She's her own. She's her own female. She's her own female. That's why I like her. I like her a lot. And she don't know that she's her own female. She's her own female. And she don't know. That's why I like her a lot. I caught a cab to the cafe to play the charming young man.
Following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips.
From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate. An incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com.
Hello, hello. It sounds like we're back. I'm Kimberly Chow. I'm the co-host of Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair on Heritage Radio Network. And I'm here joined in the studio with Evan Hanser and George Weld of Egg. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you. We're just practicing our pronunciation of different regionally inflected words.
Route 11. Route 11.
Root.
If, depending on when you're listening to this, hopefully you're getting that delightful advertisement about potato chips. We had a long conversation about crunchy, starchy chips and things earlier over lunch before we got in here. Evan, who makes a lot of biscuits and gravy as part of his job.
Mm-hmm. It's a requirement.
And expertise, recently had biscuits and gravy flavored Frito-Lay?
Yeah.
Potato chips?
Yeah, I don't mean to... promote this product to anyone, but if it happens to be in front of you and you're curious, I don't think you'll be upset if you try these chips, because they somehow did a kind of like a unnervingly good job of making it taste sort of like biscuits and gravy that I was into for a second, and it sort of made me feel uncomfortable. It's like there's some chemical magic going on here that is probably not doing me any real good.
As folks that are proponents of and creators of such delicious food that is made from stuff that comes from farms from ingredients that you recognize and are not genetically modified. Do you secretly love biscuits and gravy chips or other things? Are there any guilty pleasures that have to do with chemicals?
There are many chips that I unsecretly and publicly love. If you'd like my top 10 list of chip products, I'd be happy to give it to you personally. Please be in touch.
How do people reach you for that?
Oh, I guess that was a bad idea.
Should we tweet you?
Comment
at
on
Egg
an
restaurant?
Instagram post or something
okay.
like that.
Okay.
And I'll find a way to get back. Or come to Tables of Contents and ask a question. That would be a pretty interesting question for authors.
Question. So just a reminder, tomorrow night is the next edition of Tables of Contents, which features living authors reading live excerpts from their books.
Should be our new tagline.
living authors reading live.
It's like a mushroom forming. I just came up with that.
Yeah,
I didn't know
so
that was
going to
happen. Living authors reading live and then thoughtfully paired snacks.
And somehow it makes me think of the old live slaughter chicken slaughter places all over New York. The Viva Roma.
Live poultry markets.
Like live.
They still have some of those.
Just a couple.
Yeah. Momentarily. For now, live.
Yeah. For now.
Choose your own author.
Soon to be dinner.
Good Lord.
Yeah, we used to live around the corner. My girlfriend, Rachel, and I used to live around the corner from this one on Columbia Street that was easily identifiable, whether you could see the sign or not, from the aroma emanating from the market.
This is sort of the waterfront Red Hook area.
Yeah, exactly. And then I think it's back, but for a while it was gone because the street it was on, like there's a sinkhole or something, and half the sidewalk and the edge of the building sunk into the ground, and for years they were working on it. But I believe it's back, and the squawks and smells of that corner have returned to their former state.
I remember when I first moved here 8 years ago, and I think this was on Ractor, Gawker, or one of the other city blogs. There was a story about the smelliest block in New York City, and it was on like Ludlow and something, Eldridge, Ludlow, and there was like an investigation into what was behind there, and it was like an unmarked chicken slaughter. Mm. And people would be like, what is that smell? Walking by it on the way to Vanessa's dumplings, you know?
Right. Well, I don't want to stigmatize slaughterhouses in city limits either, because as we mentioned before, Madani Halal out in Ozone Park is one of our close food friends and purveyors who brings, you know, the chicken that we turn into, or I think very good fried chicken at Egg regularly. And also actually for Tables of Contents tomorrow is bringing us a special game bird to remain unnamed for Hernan Diaz's piece. So
come if you've been reading Hernan Diaz, maybe you can guess what
maybe
the game
guess.
Bird is. Maybe
probably
if you can guess, you'll get the list of Evan's top 10 potato
that's
chips
right that's
for
the
free.
Prize yeah
that's a pretty good prize.
I'd say it's pretty good. I mean,
well, is there something we can share with our listeners now, maybe a list of what y'all have been reading or not watching and listening to, whether to inspire your work, whether just for fun?
I've been on this weird, I guess it's not weird, it's kind of a deep dive into books about the South, trying to understand who I am and where I, you know, what, partly to try to give my understanding of Egg some context, but it's, the first thing I did was start transcribing letters that an ancestor of mine wrote from the battlefield in the Civil War. So I was reading those, and then I've been reading around that, like some history and some, I dove back into Faulkner, also to try to understand kind of the progression from like the South before the war to now, like what it's become and how it's come to be what it is and how it's come to be identified with certain kinds of foods and certain kinds of people. I just read Sally Mann's memoir, which is also sort of an interesting...
Look at Me?
Yeah.
That's on my list.
It's pretty good.
Speaking of...
That's why I was thinking about death, though, because there's a lot of stuff about death and cadavers in it that is pretty not appetizing.
I wonder what that would look like for a Tables of Contents dish.
One of you does not leave the building tonight.
speaking
not tomorrow night, though. Tomorrow night will be no cannibalism.
Yeah.
Speaking of food in the South, have you read The Cooking Gene by Michael Twitty?
I have not read The Cooking Gene. I've heard him speak about it a lot, and I've read a lot of his, I guess, excerpts from it. But
I'll lend you my copy. I definitely recommend it.
I've read a lot of great stuff about where that food came from and how it came to be, but that one is not.
Was he at SFA this year?
No, he wasn't.
No.
This year's SFA was focused on the Latinization of the South, which Southern Foodways Alliance is has a symposium every year in Oxford, Mississippi, which is a great gathering of writers and chefs and food thinkers to talk about various elements of the South's culinary identity.
Amazing.
It's an incredible gathering of people. I think the best food conference there is. And this year they were focused on the Latinization of the South, which was great and very delicious, as you can imagine.
Yeah, food conferences are the best conferences because they have to be delicious.
Yeah.
I think we should. That's a good hypothesis blanket statement.
I'm proposing this.
Okay. Putting
please,
that out there.
Please test it and get back to us.
Please affirm it.
Evan, what have you been reading?
I've been reading, not to just keep plugging, you know, Tables of Contents, but I have been captivated by so many recent authors' books. I haven't stopped recommending Victor Laval's The Changeling to everybody I see on the street or in my life. I think I bought it as a gift for no fewer than three people since he read a few months ago. Also
funny as hell.
So funny.
Reading in person.
Oh my gosh, he's amazing. He's amazing. He's perfect. My girlfriend Rachel was saying, you know, she hadn't read the book before the reading and was sitting at his table. Yeah, because that one of the nice things about the evenings is everyone sits together in our dining room. So like authors sit down in different spots, you know, next to people who are listening, and then they all eat the snacks together. So you get to it's nice and really intimate. But she was like, you know, if I had read this before that, I would have not been able to, I would have been so flustered and, fangirling over his work. And we've had a lot of people like that. I mean, I loved Alexander Chee's Queen of the Night. Just so beautiful.
He's amazing.
That book was such an
I had to, I remember, I had to leave early for that one, but I just wanted to be like, I love you.
Hey, just want to let you know.
I love you. I have to go.
And then I was reading James Hanahan's Delicious Foods, which was super crazy and awesome, and gave us maybe like the crowd favorite food moment of the last series, the sort of smushed cheese sandwich. It's just such a weird...
Can you tell us what that was?
Yeah, it's a scene where one of the protagonists is sort of eating, sort of playing with this basic cheese on white bread sandwich. And there's this description of her working it together between her hands and the way the bread is kind of collapsing and being compressed. And so we decided to make that as the dish instead of making something highbrow. We're like, let's just take that. It's such a perfect description and a food that really feels like it captures a lot about that scene and the book. But the funny story that came out of it was we were assembling these in the dining room before the reading, and Zeddy, George's daughter, is there helping us make some of the food and put together some of the other stuff. And
she's a very particular aspiring chef.
I was like, hey, can you help me make these cheese sandwiches? And totally into it. We lay them out on sheet trays, put down the bread, put down the cheese, put down the bread. I was like, okay, so now, and I was like, if I was a kid, I would love this moment. Mm-hmm. Now we're going to take him, just smush him between your hands, like flatten him out. And she gave me such a look of disbelief and concerns. I was like, how are you not taking him in? Someone's telling you to just mess with your food.
I think when I was 8 years old, that's what I did with every sandwich. Make it, or you do it in the sandwich bag. So it's like the perfect shaped ball, you know?
But she tried one, and you could see the way she's sort of hesitantly smushing this thing together. She's like, I don't like this. And after one, looked at George as if for like permission to leave this task and walked away. And
this is beneath my skills. Yeah,
apparently it was not approving.
What kind of bread and what kind of cheese?
It was just white.
Like Wonder Bread?
Yeah, like Wonder Bread. Something like Wonder Bread. And I was
wondering if you used eggs, naturally leavened bread.
Oh, no, not for this. It wouldn't have been true. Smush. Yeah, it wouldn't have been right. Although I did go to Saxelby cheese mongers and basically said, I want like kind of the best worst cheese you have. Like, I want something that's American cheese, but that's not exactly American cheese.
Limits to how low Evan can go.
Yeah. I was there tasting cheeses, and some unassuming and trusting customer came up behind me and was offered a sample of this. And little did he know that he asked what I was doing. He's like, oh, I'm a chef. I'm going to cheese the restaurant. So he thinks this person's probably tasting some of the best cheese here. And I didn't tell him I'm tasting maybe some of the worst cheese they have here. And he ended up buying like a half a pound of it. It's like, this is great. And I was like, enjoy.
Again, this is sometimes the least expensive, simple things provide the most pleasure.
Exactly. Victor Laval's book. I'm officiating a wedding for the first time in my life next weekend, which has brought me back to reading a lot of poetry, which has been great because I haven't been reading poetry regularly in a while. And lots of like my non-religious guiding texts, like Adam Phillips, and it's been an interesting revisiting of lots of things. I read a Sylvia Plath poem about mushrooms, which I found very exciting. That's the food. I mean, the reading side of things.
We already admitted that neither one of us is watching anything, but I do have a book that's visual, called Feast for the Eyes by Susie Bright, I think. It's a history of food photography.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty amazing to see, like, all the way from the beginning of photography, when they were basically trying to recreate still lives, to, you know, through the, like, famous bullet through the apple shot and to Instagram photos now. It's pretty fascinating to see, and especially now when taking pictures of food is such a thing, it's cool to see the whole context for it and the whole history for it.
Going to give a quick shout out to a friend, Jordan Kisner, who runs Bellwether. Mm-hmm. She's an artist, arts production group. She wrote the cover story for the New York Times magazine last weekend on Frances McDormand, which was so well done, and really, really awesome. And also ties into the stuff we're doing at Egg, because Alexander Kleeman actually worked with the Bellwether, and this chef and artist, Jen Monroe, to do a dinner they called the Next Menu, which is sort of envisioning once climate change has progressed 50 years from now, what we might be eating. They held that dinner at Egg, which is, again, another cool sort of gathering of disparate art and food and, I don't know, philosophy, you know, at the dinner table.
Wow.
So I was looking at lots of pictures from that, which were beautiful. What are you listening to?
What am
I asked a question.
Oh, shit.
Oh, my God.
What am I listening to? I've been listening to the Speaker Box, The Love Below. Oh, it came up, the great Outkast double album.
Everything
that came
always
up.
Comes back to Outkast.
Yeah.
It does, though. It came up in conversation over the weekend, and when I was writing today and doing my work, I put it on, and it's still really, really good.
So good.
Also really good still is, you're going to laugh when I say this, because I've always told Evan I hate listening to jazz, but
it's true.
It's Thelonious Monk's 100th birthday or 100th birthday anniversary of his death.
Are they doing the, on
it's just everywhere.
What public radio station, they do the birthday bash where they do it for 24 hours?
Oh, wow. I just keep seeing him written about everywhere. Mm. He's written about in Oxford American, I think, and in The New Yorker. And he's from North Carolina, which I didn't realize. So I dove into that. That's been cool.
Yeah, he's not...
Also still good.
Not bad, huh?
Yeah, still good.
that month.
Still good.
After
still
all
good.
These years.
Fall always brings me back to Gillian Welch, especially The Harrow and the Harvest, which I've been put on at the last few times I've been out of the city in Vermont and at the Excursion and up in Connecticut. And I was also listening to Moses Sumney's new album, The Aromanticism, which I really enjoyed. Yeah, I think that's pretty much...
Maybe as a way to wrap up to revisit Tables of Contents again, I know you always play a walkout song. Yeah. For each author. What would you choose as your...
That was a surprise.
Oh, shit.
No, I'm kidding. So actually, someone else just asked me about this, or I spilled the beans about this to someone else in an interview recently, and was like, who's... I don't know.
What would be your walkout song, though?
I don't... It's tough. I do the same thing to authors, because we don't... normally, like, they come in to read, and like, hey, quick surprise, you have to pick the song that plays with plays while people eat the food from your scene. And they're like, and I understand the feeling of like, wow, what song do I choose? It depends on the context, I feel like, so much. You know, what mood am I in? You know, is it, am I walking out to like a Kanye College Dropout song, which is very possible, or I could be walking out to something from, I would say, Harrow and the Harvest, you know, like something dirgier, and that makes me feel sad about leaving.
George?
I have never thought about... I always had my walk-in song was LaGrange by ZZ Top.
I was not expecting that.
I've never thought about leaving, so...
I guess it's like in baseball when you're walking out. So really, you're just about to start doing your thing.
Oh, so it is your walking.
If I only understood baseball more, I could better this analogy.
You're safe here, I think.
Yeah. That's with the field goal, right?
Yeah. All the points. All the points.
So many points.
You can hold that
thought. I'm going to have to think about it.
And if people
for the next few years.
Reach you on social media at Egg Restaurant about, what was the surprise question?
Chips.
Right? Sorry, I missed what was the prize for the chips. I swear I am listening to
the
our
chips
own
are
radio
the prize.
Show.
The chips
are the prize,
are
but the
prize.
Second prize can be your
walk-in. It can be your walk-in.
We can save that. Yeah. But maybe as an outro for us, we can talk about what people can expect for future Tables of Contents, hopefully. I just have in my notebook here, Salamandastron with an exclamation point, and then Angela Lansbury, which I can only say in that Lil Wayne voice. So
that's perfect.
I hear you're cooking something up at Glenwood.
Yeah, I normally do a dinner up there as a fundraiser. Glenwood's a beautiful working farm and Hudson Valley-focused nonprofit that works on ensuring that the Hudson Valley remains a place identified by and committed to food instead of being overrun with development as it has the great potential to be. So I'll do a dinner up there generally in October, and generally shout out to Heritage Foods USA in line with the Goat-tober initiative that we cook through in the month of October at Egg, where we use goats from local dairies and sort of celebrate that meat as a local sustainable source of protein and as of income for small farmers here. This year, my Glenwood dinner, where I usually use one of their goats, has been pushed to November, and Megan Larmer, who works up there and has also worked for Slow Food, she and I were chatting, and I was like, why don't we... I've always wanted to do a Sweeney Todd-themed dinner, and she was this huge Sondheim musical fan also, and she pulled out this almost unbelievable fact that Angela Lansbury, I guess, is somehow affiliated with Glenwood, either like in its founding or on its board or something. It was like, maybe we can get her to come and hang out in the room, even just being there, like forget singing, just like be there for a dinner around Sweeney Todd would be really cool.
Guest of honor.
Yes, of the highest honor.
Ms. Lansbury, if you're listening to member-funded Good Food Radio...
Please come to Cold Spring. It'll be nice. That's November 9th. If anyone's, you know, in the area, those dinners are always really beautiful. It's a gorgeous place to walk around. And the food tends to turn out pretty good as well. And then I think Salamanders, when we were talking about books we wanted to cook from, and I was always a big Redwall series, Brian Jakes fan when I was younger, as was my brother. I think that was a note about a potential Christmas gift for him. But I'd love to do something with those books at some point in the future. But we have a list.
Those mice and badgers were seriously feasting.
It's always feasting. Like every 30 pages, there was some new feast. And I didn't realize it as a kid, but it's pretty much all vegetarian because they're woodland creatures eating, you know, nuts and veggies and stuff. Except I think the otters ate shrimp. The shrimp and hot root soup was always... deep in my mind.
You're ready for this dinner.
Oh yeah, we're ready.
We're already ready. Food Book Fair 2018. Watch out, Salamandastron.
Yeah. Maybe nostalgia is the theme, and we just like do
Muriel
all sorts
of Redwall.
Muriel's there,
like the princess mouse that sails
yes.
or whatever.
Oh my God,
what the hell?
We're gonna have to catch.
Out,
we're gonna have to catch you up on that after we sign off.
Homework to do.
Yeah, there's only like 20 books or something, so I'm sure you'll book them in no time.
There's so many books. Sorry, not sorry for anyone who's never read Redwall and is listening to this and are a little confused.
Yeah,
but
sorry, you're welcome.
I'm there with you. Read them. I'm right there with you.
Okay, I'm gonna add that to add a revisit to my reading list, and we'll talk about how we can do some badger style feasting. Yeah. Okay, that's Salamandastron calling me right now. But we got to sign off. This has been Recommended Aww. Reading with Food Book Fair with Evan and George from Egg. Thanks so much for joining us today on Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks, Kim.
Bye, thanks.
See you at Tables of Contents.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Recommended Reading is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.